Amid the maelstrom of the drama around diplomacy with North Korea, it's easy to forget that South Korea and the United States are themselves engaged in a fairly serious trade dispute over taxes put in place by Washington on imported solar panels and washing machines. This has caused significant tensions between South Korea and the United States, coming at a time when these longtime security allies need to be in lockstep to advance the denuclearization of North Korea. Our guest today, Dr. June Park, is a political economist who has been carefully monitoring the ongoing dispute for years. She is currently an adjunct professor of global affairs at the George Mason University, Korea, and a non-resident James A. Kelly Korea Fellow at the Pacific Forum. She is the author of a KAI report on the effects of the U.S.-China trade war on Korea's solar panel industry. We will link the paper in the description to the podcast. She sat down with KAI's Junhee Kim to provide us with her views on the ongoing trade disputes in the Asia-Pacific region, with a particular focus on Korea. A quick note, in describing the factors influencing South Korea's approach to trade, Dr. Park mentions VIP. This refers to Korea's presidential office. With that, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., this is Korean Context.
You gave an excellent presentation here talking about some of the challenges that the South Korean solar energy industry is going through because of recent U.S. safeguards that were placed, not only on South Korea, but also China as well. Do you mind sharing some of the background behind why you did the research and what attracted you to the project?
While I was doing my PhD dissertation research back in early 2000s or late 2000s or early 2010s, the actual norm or term of trade war was kind of controversial because a lot of people who had just had a glimpse at my work, like just an abstract or something, they would think like, yeah, trade wars, they happened in the 1980s and the 1930s. What we have right now is the aftermath of a global financial crisis. And I did work on financial policies at that point as well. But I just thought that the international political economy field treated separately finance and trade work. And to me, it seemed like protectionism is sort of a political tool from the U.S. side that keeps happening in a recurring kind of cycle. And when I was looking at Northeast Asia in general, I sensed that these are export-oriented economies. They need to be taken special care of from the United States perspective. And I also thought that Japan and Korea and China are treated similarly from the U.S. perspective. When I started writing separate country chapters, and I lived in these countries in order to get a better understanding of how the trade policies worked, I lived in Japan for a year, China for a year, and I did on and off research in Korea. I just thought that there has to be some kind of a variance that's happening, like underneath. And my argument in the dissertation was basically that we can't just say Japan and South Korea are military allies to the United States, so they would bow or acquiesce. Ultimately, what I found was Japan acquiesces, South Korea refutes, and China escalates. But we need to find like a real explanation as to why that is happening. And my answer was not the geopolitical factor, but that what kind of institutional measures are already in place for them to exercise their trade policy is what's making their ultimate decision-making different. So I'm just going too much into my book project, but basically in Japan and South Korea, the political systems, although they're democracies, Japan has a parliamentary system in which the technocrats rule. And the technocrats are usually on top of the trade policymaking scene, whereas in Korea, it's the presidency that calls the shots. In China, the trade bureaucracy is more of an empowered agent of the principal, which is the Politburo. So my argument was that there has to be a two-step approach here. So step one, you track down, identify who the dominant player in trade policy is. And then step two is trying to kind of get to the core of what their policy preferences are. And in the case of Japan, the dominant player is MOF, Ministry of Finance, and METI, Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. In South Korea, it's actually the VIP, sort of aided by the presidents. And China, it's the Politburo, but they have what is called the Central Committee on Economic and Financial Affairs, which has been upgraded from a small leading group. So I dissected their different preferences, and I discovered there are some areas in electronics that South Korea has specific interest in, and where the U.S. doesn't see eye to eye with South Korea, even in the presence of the free trade agreement. And those were washing machines and solar. And in 2014, when South Korea filed a WTO dispute, I think what everybody was thinking was washing machines? And solar had been like an ongoing thing. Even in 2012, China and Taiwan were targeted, and they were both given anti-dumping and countervailing duty impositions. At the time, South Korea was not in the game, and much of the blame was just placed on China, India, Taiwan. But now that South Korea is a big producer, and now that the blame is also on South Korea, I think there is this big concern toward how South Korea's solar industry would evolve. And that's where I kind of try to think hard about how this is related to energy policy, because usually we try to think separately, like trade and finance separate from each other, energy and trade separate from each other, but we're entering an era in which things are very interrelated and sort of intricate in terms of matter. And I think trade policy right now is very tied to climate change policies. So without having to get too much into the nitty-gritty of climate change policy, I started from looking at solar from the trade perspective.
The topics that you choose to study are very timely.
Well, nobody was interested in trade wars at that point. Trying to look at the patterns of trade policymaking from the U.S. side, from the Japan side, Korea side, China side, I think there was a prelude to like a big trade conflict in the coming years, because China was growing at an exponential speed, and the kind of transformation I was seeing in China was enough for me to believe that there would be a trade conflict, like in serious terms. And then you have a very strong leadership, and then you have a strong man in the White House. So I think there were some signs even years before, and it just happened with the Trump presidency. There was a little bit of, you know, skepticism from some China scholars that I encountered while I was doing my PhD dissertation writing, and I still understand, like, where they were coming from, but now I think the optics are pretty clear. You know, China wants to get ahead of the United States, and the U.S. also has this sort of a counter argument that it wants to stay in number one place.
Do you think there's something that can help alleviate some of those tensions, or something that specifically the South Korean solar energy industry, something that they can do to prevent some of those costs from coming into their industry?
To alleviate tension, there are many ways to do this, but my good feeling was, so I attended the Washington International Trade Association intensive trade seminar for the past 2 days while I was here in Washington, and even there were discussions about, of course, China, but NAFTA, Canada, Mexico. There was also discussion about Korea and Japan in a different context. And my good feeling is that even within Washington, there are divided views about whether CORUS should be defended or not. And just to maintain CORUS, of course, there could be different ways of doing this. We all know that the North Korean nuclear threat sort of put a stall on scrapping CORUS. But what's important to me in figuring out whether it could be alleviated is how governments approach the issue. And one way that the Koreans tried to do it is by buying more natural gas. But the concept of trade deficit from the macroeconomic perspective is just not that meaningful. Politically, it's very meaningful, but it may not be on economic terms. And the appeasement strategy, or whatever you would call it, to make each other satisfied, there are different ways other than buying the energy sources. It's more about trying to understand whether services or product-based, goods-based trade would really pay off for both sides in the game. And what I noticed in the seminar that I was attending was basically people who are in the services sector, they are happy about the FTA. People who are not in the services sector, they are not very happy about the FTA. So for any producer in America or any producer from the Korean perspective, of course, the deficits are on the U.S. side, like overall. But that can't really dictate who's winning or who's losing. That in and of itself is very clear. And if you really want to fix that, one way to do it is to bring the factories here and produce it. But I'm not sure if that would actually lead to the strengthening of the CORUS FTA. The real point is trying to engage in more trade as fit, as the global economy transforms itself and as countries adapt to the changes in the global economy. I think Korea has to do its job. America also has to do its job in promoting its own exports. And just looking at the washing machines case, I've seen the exhibits by Whirlpool, Kenmore, these companies, vis-a-vis Samsung, LG, and these other South Korean producers. And I was thinking, there has to be promotion of exports policy from the U.S. side, not just in terms of policy per se, but there has to be like a real drive from the domestic sector. If manufacturing is losing too much, or if the U.S. feels that manufacturing sector is weak, you can't just blame the counterparts. There has to be work from within. You can't just say, oh, we're out of money. There has to be some work in order to drive R&D, in order to foster new development, and not just blame it on external producers. Because what I sense from the exhibits, I saw the files, and it looks like, okay, there may have been some patent fights between Samsung and Apple, but on the washing machine side, I could clearly tell that there has been more engineering R&D going on from the South Korean side. And therefore, it's attractive. People buy it. Not a cheerleader for Samsung, but it's easy to use. And compared to Whirlpool and Kenmore, I could see that the technology was quite different. So without that, from the U.S. manufacturing side, there will still be these kinds of conflicts because, okay, you are basically asking the government to protect you because you're getting out of business. You just can't hold the competition anymore. At the same time, you don't have an export strategy to gain access to other work. What's really of critique to the Trump administration right now is that it's closing additional markets. And I don't know how that could be a solution for the Trump administration. Like for manufacturing even, I just don't see where that's going to come about in terms of like, okay, so far under people like Bob Selig or Susan Schwab, it was all about expanding markets. Expanding markets alone is not going to do the job. You need to promote R&D. You need to also produce quality items that could be trustworthy and attractive, globally marketable. And I would suggest the same for South Korean producers as well, not just on solar energy, but other areas. You need to protect your IP. You also need to keep on doing good work on research and development. So that's on you. That's not for the government to like resolve. Of course, the safeguard in this context seems very politicized. Llewellyn Hughes has co-authored an article that sort of lays out all of the internal dynamics by these petitioners, Suniba and Solar World, who were original petitioners for the safeguard. Solar World is basically a branch of the German company, Solar World USA, and Suniba, the owner, is basically a Hong Kong firm. So you can't technically say that they're 100% legit U.S. firms. They are operating in the U.S., but the real question is now the global supply chain is very different compared to, like, let's say, 1980s, even 1990s. And you're just trying to see everything from the bilateral perspective. That's just not going to work. Of course, trade cases is still bilateral. But the chain is different, and the way things are sold, transactions are made, is very different from the past. So I think there is some kind of misunderstanding from the Trump administration on that part, and their solution to it is more from the bilateral perspective. I think going forward, South Korea already has manifested its discontent at these kinds of tariffs or safeguard based on Section 201, and they've already filed in WTO disputes. And we'll have to see how that plays out, although right now the Trump administration is threatening to leave the WTO. And some of the trade hawks in the Trump administration, I think these measures at the WTO or dispute settlement process at the WTO does not seem that useful to the U.S. But it has been there, and it has served many, many countries, including the United States, for a better regulated trade. On the South Korean side, I think there would be considerable push and pull factors going on with regard to the case in the WTO. Even if it doesn't progress immediately, South Korea will keep on defending its interests in the WTO and exercising its interests through its trade remedy laws.
Do you have any final thoughts or last words that you would like to share?
I think this is a very interesting time to look at Korea. And as someone who does not just Korea, but East Asia, U.S. relations, I think that there is a time for everything. And at this point in time, I think many international relations scholars are sort of puzzled at what's going on, and especially when one looks at Korea without the background knowledge on Korea, it's hard to say anything definite. Even with knowledge on Korea, it's hard to say anything definite. You could take a political position at it, but not in the most scientific way possible or the rational way possible, because there's so much uncertainties arising from the Trump administration and also from the North Korean side. I think probably the most sort of readable is probably the Moon administration. So I'm hoping that anyone who is interested in Korea or Korea-related affairs, East Asia in general, I'm hoping that they would take the time to sort of understand the history of it a little bit more. I see considerable lack. When I see my students, especially international students, they would benefit from more reading of East Asian history, contemporary history, especially in the trade dynamic history. Not much of that area has been investigated. Still, the dominant field is security when it comes to East Asia. And I'm hoping that the new generation scholars or people who are working on their research projects as PhD students or master's students, I'm hoping that they would take a closer look at how the trade war dimensions are evolving at all fronts, not just the EU, NAFTA, but also East Asia. But I'm hoping they would look at it from a more comparative lens, you know, vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis Japan, vis-a-vis Korea, and then would be able to more systematically analyze what is going to happen in the future.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to June Park for being with us today, and to you, listeners, for tuning in. June Park's paper presented at KAI is called Renewable Energy in Trade Wars, Solar Power in South Korea's Energy Mix and the Impact of Protectionism. We will add a link to the paper in the description. If you have any comments or questions, send us a tweet at KOREAECONINST. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page, where you can stream our events live and tune in for Korea This Week every Monday at 2 p.m. when we review the most important developments on the Korean Peninsula. See you there!